I'm just going to briefly introduce Bridget from her bio. She's a senior lecturer in actual studies at the Australian National University in Canberra. She joined ANU in 2011 after serving as the Life Chief Pricing Actuary at Partner Reinsurance Europe, where she was responsible for all the aspects of pricing of Partner Re's life portfolio worldwide, including long-term care insurance in several markets. Prior to working with Partners, Bridget worked in a variety of actuarial roles with Zurich Financial Services and Hazel Carr. And if anybody was at the presentation in this room immediately prior, there was some discussion about long-term care, so it's really good that she follows on from that. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, James. And I should add to that bio also a non-Twitter user. So you can tweet me as much as you like, but I'll have no idea. So actually, the last time I spoke at the convention 2 years ago on the topic of long-term care insurance to talk about just some of the products I had seen overseas, and I finished with a reflection about what I perceived to be some of the reasons why there was no long-term care insurance product in Australia. So just to be clear, when we're talking about long-term care insurance, so we're talking about aged care, the need for help at home or in a residential aged care facility, and insurance products exist in various markets around the world to help pay for the extra costs involved in getting that assistance, whether it's at home or in a facility. So having established my own thoughts on the matter, I thought it would be quite worthwhile to actually go out and consult with the financial services industry and see whether their views coincided with my own or not. Because there are a lot of possible reasons for why a market or a product doesn't exist. So I went out and surveyed in a targeted way. I targeted people who I thought might actually have a view on the product, have had a reason to think about it. So I targeted the Life Board of the Financial Services Council and the Life Insurance and Wealth Management Practice Committee of the Institute, plus other people I knew had an interest in it. And that snowballed through to some other interested parties. And I did it in two ways. I had an online survey where I got 26 responses out of about 40 people approached, so I was quite happy with that response rate. And people at the end of that survey were offered the opportunity to participate in a follow-up interview in person, and I conducted 6 interviews actually talking to people in more depth about their views about the product. And as an academic, as a relative newcomer to academia, I've learned all about the world of grant funding, so I actually had to apply for a research grant to fund this particular piece of research, which was successful with National Seniors, which is a lobby group for the older person, and the report is actually launched on their website. The full report has been launched on their website today, and I'll make the link available on the actuary site if you're interested in reading more. In terms of the respondents, I think it probably was a little more actuary-heavy than I was hoping for. Hard to say for the online component because that was anonymous, so I don't know for sure. But I was really looking for as broad as possible a view, and I'm not sure I have that yet. But I think I have a reasonable view from the actuarial sphere. So the online survey covered awareness of provision of aged care in Australia today, how that's actually financed and the reforms that are currently taking place that Clive referred to briefly, and awareness of the concept of long-term care insurance. And then there's some discussion around support for the concept and barriers and a little bit covering views on future directions. So that's what I'm going to talk about here. So can I start, actually, by asking people in the room, just raise your hand if you think you have an understanding of how aged care works in Australia today. Yep, so that's pretty, I think you'll see that's fairly typical. There are people who really know their stuff for whatever reason, and there's the vast majority who really don't, haven't given it much thought for whatever reason. And those people who have an awareness, I'd be interested to know whether it was split, whether it was because of work-related activity or whether it was through personal experience. Usually it's one or other of those means. And how many people then are aware of the work of the Productivity Commission and the subsequent reforms introduced by the government, Living Longer, Living Better, the catchily named package of reforms, a subset of the people who raised their hands before. So there's actually, there is activity going on that I think most people in financial services are quite rightly not aware of at all. So, you know, you're not alone. This is the survey responses, if you like. The survey said, you know, what was the awareness of aged care arrangements? Basically split about 50-50 between little knowledge or some knowledge, no actuary or respondent claimed detailed knowledge. But no one said they knew nothing at all. But as we went through the questions into how is it actually financed and the current reforms, the lack of awareness, you know, really rose quite significantly. And to be honest, I think that's perfectly reasonable, and some of the comments supported that, that it's not a focus in people's business at the moment, and therefore it has no business relevance. So unless they've had a reason to deal with the system for personal reasons, they're not really exposed to it. And even those who've been exposed for personal reasons often feel that they don't actually understand the system, even though they've had to deal with it. On the other hand, when I moved to talking about the concept of an insurance product, there was reasonably, well, quite satisfying awareness of insurance products. So I asked people spontaneously, in an unprompted way, what countries they were aware of that an insurance product, a long-term care insurance product, existed. And people sort of successfully identified the US, which is the largest current market in the world. They also identified France, which is the second largest market. They, very interestingly, second most popular answer was the UK, where there currently is no long-term care insurance market. I think that they were either thinking there must be, you know, because the UK is the largest life insurance market, I suppose, after the US, so, and they seem to have very high penetration of all forms of insurance. Or they might have been thinking of some legacy products that used to exist which have been withdrawn from sale. Or they might have been thinking of what's called immediate needs annuities, which help fund the cost of nursing care, but are not a form of pre-funded actual long-term care insurance. And somebody, as you can probably see in the small print, somebody identified Australia and named a product, which I'm still trying to track down, actually. If anyone knows what this product might be, I'd be very interested to hear from them. Another important aspect that I really wanted to get to people's views on is the concept of whether they consider the risk to be insurable. Because certainly if in the wider world and in the academic literature, there are fairly respected voices who maintain that for all sorts of reasons, this is not an insurable risk. It's too long-term and too much uncertainty. So I worded my question not very well. It implied my biases, saying, if you think it's not insurable, please explain why. And only four people answered this question. So I'm going to take that as meaning the other 22 felt that it is an insurable risk, which I felt was very positive. And in fact, of the four people who did answer, their comments showed that they actually think it is insurable. So things like, it is insurable, but it's a question of degree. Or maybe it's an insurable on a fixed benefit, but not on an indemnity basis. Or it should be insurable, but there's an issue of demand and awareness, which are true. So from that point of view, I'm starting to feel fairly optimistic. People feel that it should be insurable. And when I asked them how suitable a couple of different products, I kind of outlined the basic principles of the French and the US product, how suitable some sort of product would be for the Australian market. Asked quite a long-winded question, but three quarters of them said that they felt that a private voluntary insurance product that paid a benefit to assist with care needs could be a worthwhile product in Australia. So this is all sounding pretty promising. But the only comment that I got at this particular question, I think, is very indicative of what's to come. Yes, but the market's not ready for it. And now we're going to see, we're going to see some supporting messages, but we're going to see a lot of perceived barriers. So in terms of supporting the product, the two key reasons for supporting the product were financial need. People can believe they see that there must be a financial need. And you'll see that the level of confusion about how aged care works and how much it costs and who pays what is such that we do get quite conflicting comments around this topic. But in general, I think people sense that it costs a lot, and therefore there must be a need to finance, and therefore insurance maybe can play a role. And this particular quote is saying that, you know, they had their personal experience of someone who was unable to fund any choice of care, which in reality shouldn't happen, so I don't know what exactly happened in that person's experience. But apart from the financial need, of course, the other obvious aspect is the ageing population. So people are just saying to themselves, well, we've got a lot more older people, this care costs a lot, so a product should work, there should be a role. But the barriers came through, sort of thick and fast. Perception that consumers are just won't be interested, aren't interested and aren't aware, and that it's going to be very difficult to generate that demand. That there's a misunderstanding that the state will provide. The state will provide, but only after certain, you know, at certain levels of assets and income. So the sort of idea that the state will look after me, so I don't need to provide for this time of life. A view that for this to work, to overcome consumer resistance, is going to require some form of government intervention, whether it be by tax concessions or other people evoked the possibility of compulsion as well, which, you know, would have to be done in a way that was palatable to the population as a whole. And other comments really were quite insightful as well. You know, the last session talked about underinsurance in Australia, and if you move through the life cycle, it's hard enough to get people to retire with adequate income without, you know, and then try and encourage them to save for something that may or may not happen well after retirement. And the countervailing view that says, well, actually, my impression is that the care's fairly good, especially if you don't have resources, so is there really a need? And you'll see that sort of opposing points of view, which I think, again, reflect the general uncertainty and lack of sort of thorough understanding of how the system works. I did ask people to choose between the French and the US model. So the French is kind of like a participating product on a fixed benefit basis, whereas the US product is a shorter term benefit, usually an indemnity style. And basically, I think not surprisingly, most people hadn't given it much thought, so they sort of just said they didn't have a preference. Very little interest in the French model. Not because it's French, I assume, but rather because the participation structure with profits is so far from the Australian mindset these days that it was just not going to be a winner, doesn't have a natural appeal. I'll just show you the graph there of the sort of split between the US model that was relatively popular, which is when it's combined with other forms of life insurance rather than on a standalone basis. But what was most interesting were the comments that people provided. So most people felt that it would work best as a rider, so integrated into some other form of insurance or attached to super. I guess that's as a way, I think we were talking about linking in the last session, as a way to sort of like make a bit of sugar to go with the pill, for example, to convince people that this is a good product. a lot of comments about the fact that the challenge is really about attitudes to the risk and attitudes to providing for the risk, and that we can't automatically bring overseas experience to Australia because it's the integration with state benefits that's really key, and because every country has its own particular way of dealing with aged care, the insurance solutions tend to be very country-specific as well. Further comment on participating, the need for transparency and clarity in whatever solution, and my personal favourite with very nice direct actuarial style, no variation would be saleable. So that's, you know, I think that's an absolutely fair point of view as a starting point. But my aim was really to identify the barriers that would need to be dealt with in order for a product to become feasible. So these were comments that were asked for in an unstructured way, and there is, I tried to structure people's views on the barriers a little bit more formally. So there is literature out there that kind of lists all the reasons why a product wouldn't work, and breaking it down into supply-side issues, so issues from the point of view of the insurer, and demand-side issues from the point of view of consumers. So I asked people to rank this rather long list of problems, and basically what they came up with was things like, well, limited profitability due to limited size, that they don't see the potential for a very large market in this arena, regulatory constraints, and in particular, I think, regulatory stability, because this is such a long-term risk that, you know, governments are not known the world over for their long-term planning. So getting an insurance product that correctly meshes with a changing regulatory landscape is pretty challenging. General uncertainty around future costs and designing of the product. But there were some other very helpful comments. So this concept of cost, I don't know, I don't find it very helpful when people say it's an expensive product. I mean, it depends. I think what the issue is that people don't perceive value for money for whatever reason. I don't think it would be absolutely expensive per se, but the idea that it would only appeal to a very certain particular subsection of the population, it's just too long-term. You know, in general, and I share this view, Australians are not particularly good at paying now for something that may or may not happen a very long time in the future, that it just doesn't really appeal to consumers, and there'll be some more comments on that front. And that this one I thought was a very interesting contrarian viewpoint, suggesting why there might be a market may not develop, that there is the potential for improved government provision of services, thus removing the need for private insurance. So I guess that's a possibility, but I think I would put that on the... I would personally rank that as a fairly low likelihood potential outcome. If anything, I think the government, part of the reforms that are going on at the moment involve increasing in user pays, for example, and I would expect, if anything, the government is more likely to withdraw support rather than increase support. But let's see. On the demand side, the ranking, yes, came through that the complexity and the high cost of the products came through as the number one barrier to demand. Now, I assume that's not insurers thinking that their products are complex and costly, but I think it's their impression of what consumers think, that this product is complicated and expensive. And it is a relatively complex product. They commented they think that consumers really... ignorance is one, you know, that consumers just don't think about this risk They're not aware of the potential need. And that they, if they do think about it, perhaps they have this misunderstanding that it's completely funded by the state. At least they didn't think distrust of financial services was a barrier to providing a product. So that was positive. And other comments, this whole issue, I also called this age paradox, that you get this issue where when you're young, you don't, when you could afford to buy the insurance, you're not worried about the risk. When you're older and you realise that this is a real, you know, clear and present danger, if I might characterise it that way, the insurance would become too expensive. Similarly, this sort of wealth paradox, high net worth can afford to pay whatever it might cost for all the extras and so on that you can pay for, and less wealthy individuals will be paid, will be covered by the state. So is there really actually a financial need? And I'm sort of yet to get to the bottom of that, that paradox. Looking to future directions, I'll get my animation right. I asked people what they thought the impact of the Living Longer, Living Better package that will should pass into legislation in the next few weeks, whether that would increase the likelihood of a market for an insurance product developing. And people were like, OK, a third of them didn't know, half were fairly positive, and a sort of very low percentage said no. But when I actually cross-referenced that back to the level of awareness, what I found was that people who actually knew something about the package were pretty pessimistic about its likely influence on developing, you know, on a product or a market developing, whereas the people who didn't know anything about the reforms thought, well, yes, either they didn't know or they thought, yes, it should have a positive impact. So in the end, even those yeses were perhaps not very well-informed yeses, if I can say that. So, you know, people feel that, you know, this whole issue, it's the future, it's only an issue if you, you know, this sort of issue if you... if you have sufficient assets, you'll be fine. If you don't, the government will pay. So, where's, you know, nobody's aware of it. We've got this Australian attitude, she'll be right. You know, we can't get people to insure for lots of other things. How will we ever get them to insure for this? On the yes side, there's still that vague feeling that, you know, it's going to cost more. There's a transfer of costs onto users. So this should encourage the potential for a market. When I talk to them about just the fact that, you know, there's an increasing focus on the older population, people were more optimistic about that having an impact, that as we become aware of a larger proportion of the population being older aged and entering into the age where they need care, confident that awareness will increase. Whether that's through seeing the demographic changes or experience with relatives or what have you, but also very aware that challenges remain, that, you know, the likelihood is low, that it's going to take a long time and it's going to be a real sales challenge. So my conclusions were that there is an understanding of a growing need overall, that there's an openness in the industry, which I found very reassuring, that there's an openness in the industry that insurance ought to be able to play a role, but at the moment the negatives well and truly outweigh the positives. The personal interviews were very helpful to complement this sort of structured interview, because it allowed people to bring out points that weren't raised in the online survey and gave quite a few different perspectives on the issue. So some of the themes that emerged from the follow-up interviews were some issues around product development, why the products failed in other countries, a lot of commentary around current stresses in the actual supply of care itself and why people feel that should contribute to the potential for insurance. Some pretty clear views on the role of government, some exploration of where the financial exposure may actually lie, and some quite perceptive comments about not only do we have an issue of ignorance of the risk, but we have active avoidance of facing the risk. And when you add that into the mix, selling an insurance product, finding the right angle to convince people that they might want to consider insurance against this risk is going to be particularly interesting. And lastly, I touched on to what extent personal experience had influenced people's views. On the product development front, not surprisingly, most people's experience in the past had been via their reinsurer. Either they were a reinsurer and they've actively worked with products overseas, or they've been, you know, the product idea has been marketed to them by reinsurers as a sort of very common vector for product development. Everybody commented that tailoring to the local market's absolutely key, similar to what was identified in the online survey. And there was comments about finding that magic formula to make it work, and the fact that it really does need to be oriented. You know, the first and foremost is not the product design or the pricing, which actually I thought would be people's preoccupations, but rather the design and the consumer appeal, actually finding a product that would appeal to people, and sort of unpicking why the product, while it has been relatively successful in some markets, has also been a failure in other markets. There have been markets where it's been launched and just hasn't taken off in the way expected at all. In the stresses in supply of care, there were some very interesting comments, which was something that I hadn't raised in the online survey. And I think this is where people's underlying feelings about the risk really came out. So these sort of comments, you know, looking at it from the individual's point of view, that there's something is not right in the way the system works at the moment. If you have people saying, you know, it's not affordable, people can't choose, they just have to take whatever's going because that's all there is. You know, not sure how much of a choice is actually available, or unhappy with the quality of their choices, particularly when going into residential aged care. And so I actually think there is a, to me this hints at the way a product could be structured is about giving people control and giving people more options and choices at a time, which tends to be a stressful time in any family when you're deciding about care needs for an elderly person. But at the moment we have some pretty unhappy consumers, and comments from the aged care service provider's point of view, so either people who are involved in aged care provision or have done that consulting work, for example, that there's no mileage in aged care facilities at the moment. They're hard to make money out of. A lot of them are losing money. If we extend it out to retirement villages, we've got retirement villages going into receivership. So we've got a sector that should be growing and is growing in some respects, but is losing money. So now we've got individuals who are unhappy and a sector that's losing money. So we've kind of got a lose-lose situation at the moment. And if it starts costing the government more and more, then we'll have a lose-lose-lose situation. And it seems hard to imagine that insurance couldn't play a role in freeing up some of that stress. However, when people thought about how that might happen, I think they felt that no individual insurer could take the lead, that if anything is to happen, it's going to be an industry-wide and possibly even broader than industry effort. Because the industry, you know, if the industry says, you know, we should do something, they'll just be seen as self-interested. And so they felt that it would be ideal if the government could enter to raise awareness of the risk and the potential costs. Well, although I think that poses an extra challenge, which is then the government has to say something about its role in providing and financing aged care. There's a need for stability. I've already commented about whether that's realistic. And this implication of, you know, if the government then says, well, actually we can't pay for everything, then how sort of straightforward of, as a message is that to deliver to the electorate? A little bit about where the exposure is, and we've got this sort of paradox of people saying, well, you know, if you need care, the government will provide. On the other hand, I think people are saying, well, you know, you can have very significant financial exposure, and not just in amounts, but also in time. The previous presenter showed that, you know, most people maybe only spend 18 months in residential aged care, but some people spend much longer. So there's kind of the tail risk element. But it's also about having enough money to choose your own care and fund the care that you want beyond perhaps what will be provided by the state. So people evoke this issue of the impact of choice, that if you introduce, a bit like with the education system, if you introduce the possibility of paying for something that people at least perceive as better, then some people will choose to do that. And then this sort of countervailing view that there isn't actually an issue. And I think this really does reinforce this issue of the lack of general understanding about how the system works, how much you have to pay, and this sort of the growth in financial advice around aged care is primarily, in my understanding, is around arranging your assets and your income to maximise state benefits. And I'm not sure that that's really a productive long-term use of financial advice. Anyway, moving on to avoidance of facing the risk itself, this is something that people spoke very well to, that, you know, basically this is something that most of us don't want to think about. Massive resistance to going into a residential aged care facility because this is, you know, admission of it's the last step, so to speak, that people don't want to think about it, so it makes it very hard to sell any sort of insurance around it. There's this issue of thinking it won't happen to me, and under insurance in general. So, you know, with this active avoidance, I think it makes it even more challenging. And again, it's an issue of finding the angle that says you won't have to think about it because, you know, this will be taken care of by your insurance, for example. Lastly, I asked people about whether they felt that their own experience, for example, of dealing with a relative or other family member going into aged care, whether that would actually influence them to do something about any negative aspects of their experience in their own work life. And I asked them this because that was my own sort of thesis. I had a colleague who effectively lobbied for us to introduce long-term care or participate in the long-term care insurance market precisely because of his own experiences with his mother overseas. And most people said that it would, of course, bring the issues front of mind, but it wouldn't actually influence any action in their professional life. And when I sort of probed that a little bit further, it was mainly because they felt there was just no interest in their organisation, so they wouldn't get, you know, it would fall on deaf ears. So my conclusion was perhaps a very cautious optimism. You know, there is an openness to the concept of insuring it. There is a general sort of vague feeling that there must be a need. But the hurdles are definitely, you know, can't be understated at the moment. And insurers feel that possibly the way to break the nexus or break the blockage is to work with government. Clearly, this is a very small study. It's not representative. It's not an official industry view. I wouldn't want to claim any representativeness as such, and I should, even if all the barriers were removed, it doesn't guarantee that a product would develop. This is all very hypothetical. And I would like to acknowledge both the funding I received and also Aaron Brune, who's not going to appreciate it, me mentioning his name, for giving me the idea for this research in the first place. And I'd be very interested to hear from people about any further input in general or further suggestions for investigating the potential or solving any of these open questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
We have got about 10 minutes for questions, so if anybody has anything. Yep. Can you use the mic? Thanks.
Hi, Bridget. Thanks for the presentation. I enjoyed it very much. Queenie from Government Actuary. So I'd like to hear your view on whether the introduction of NDIS and NRIS has further reduce the need or demand for private long-term care insurance in Australia, and whether you think such a sort of a public insurance product would be the best way to provide long-term care in Australia. Thank you.
Thanks. That's an excellent question. I think NDIS, I'm not an expert, but I gather it's just been extended now for people who become disabled before 65, now stay in NDIS rather than transferring over to aged care, whereas aged care is primarily for people who become need help through chronic disease in much older age. So that's a quite a different population. But the fact that we have this thing called NDIS, which isn't really insurance but exists with government support, I think does possibly open the potential for some form of social insurance solution for long-term care in Australia, for sharing the cost of long-term care between the public and private sector. Just restructuring. At the moment, long-term care, the government provision of long-term care is funded from general revenue. And I think that's the question. Is that a realistic funding source given demographic change? And social insurance, I think, is definitely one. It's definitely the solution that has been chosen in many countries. So it would be on the table, for sure.
Hi, Alyssa Holtz from RGA. I wanted to find out if anyone raised the issue of substitute products that are available in the Australian market. I'm thinking particularly TPD with the loss of independent existence definition post age 65. Do we as an industry feel we've solved this problem?
How long does that benefit last?
Up to age 99, but it's a lump sum benefit.
Right.
So I guess my view is insurance companies don't want to take on the longevity
the,
risk.
The income stream.
They don't want to take on the income stream. They don't want to have guarantees on their
yep.
premium rates. And, yeah, the discounting of a prepaying a benefit with YRT.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lump sum is certainly better than nothing. I don't know to what extent, I mean, what the claims experience is like and how big the portfolio is past sort of 75.
Yeah. I don't think we have a lot of experience post age 65.
Yeah.
And we have a high lapse rate, so I don't know that consumers
understand that it's worth
understand that it could be
used, because there's a sort of a activities of daily living type definition after 65. Yeah, so that I think that would probably be a cost-effective way to at least open people's minds to the possibility. Could be a good solution.
With the tax changes to deferred lifetime annuities, I was wondering how you see that in this context. I guess with an ageing population, people are worried about living longer and healthier, just as much as they would be probably about needing care. And I guess to what extent do you think a deferred lifetime annuity might be a better proposition in terms of having an income stream from a certain older age after retirement versus having a payment based on the need for care?
Exactly. I mean, I actually think that they you know, they're both talking about sort of tail risks in a sense, and a deferred lifetime annuity very much focused on continuing your income after a certain time. And what's particularly interesting is there are product ideas where you get an income stream that steps up when you reach a care need, which implies additional expenses. That's really what it's for. It's to complement your existing income and resources to help pay for the extra costs that you incur when you need care. And done properly, in combination even with a deferred lifetime annuity, it could be relatively good value for money. And they're quite nice diversifying risks as well, which is what's made the US products quite successful, because they're tied in with lifetime annuities and they get that offset of the two risks.
Yeah, thanks for your presentation, Bridget. I could speak for a very long time about this, but I'm not going to. I think one of the things that's absolutely essential is provider connection, and you've really approached your survey from the point of view of funders.
Mm-hmm.
But as in healthcare, providers are really the essential people here because they will provide the services. And aged care is even more complicated than health insurance. Health insurance is a tripartite contract. Aged care really, I think, has four parties to it. The person, the funder, you've got the relatives and the actual provider of the
service.
The service, yeah. Yep. So it's very complicated. I can confirm to you that residential aged care is generally well supplied in Australia generally. But what is not well supplied are services at home.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the key services that most older people want now, because they don't want to go into residential facilities, which are truly horrifying.
And that's okay. Where the increased user pays is going to hit more in the home care as well, isn't it?
Yes. Home care services are very poor at the moment. And what the longer living better, if that's what it's called, services, I understand, will do is it will move funding to the client, if you like, or their family,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
as opposed to the provider of that service.
Yes, this and sort of consumer-directed idea.
Yeah,
yes.
It's potentially a seismic change. Working with governments will need a change in government, because this government doesn't think about, it just thinks about the government providing things. It doesn't think about working with the private sector.
Mm.
And we've seen that with NDIS, where some parts of NDIS could definitely have been provided by the private sector and the life insurance industry, although in my experience there is a reluctance in the life insurance industry to get involved in this, and that may in fact be APRA determined. I think that if you are going to go further in this, you need to look at service provision.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening in Sydney now is that for about $130,000 a year, no government intervention whatsoever, houses, share houses are opening up. And whether these, for older people,
mm-hmm,
and whether these would be successful or not, it's too early to say at this stage, but it's an entirely new model of care, which isn't residential, and it isn't having services provided in your own home.
And it's not a retirement village.
And it's not a retirement village,
right.
That's right. So these are not horrifying places. At home, of course, is a very risky place as well for many older people.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think that's really all I've got to say, except that I would encourage you to further develop your ideas in this, because it is a really important area, and to concentrate more short term potentially on the provision of services out of traditional environments.
Mm-hmm.
Because more people like me, who have responsibility for older people, are realising just how time-consuming this is and frustrating.
Thank you. No, I mean, I have to say, I mean, I'm a neophyte in terms of studying the risk and particularly with respect to Australia. And every time I look at another angle, I find it enormously fascinating and challenging. There's so many puzzles.
Yep.
In the way it works.
The other problem with dementia is that every person with dementia is different and they need different services. And so this is a massive challenge to providing services to that area for people who are generally poorly paid.
Well, that as well, yes, into the bargain. Thank you.
Hi, Bridget. Darren Wickham. Thank you very much for an excellent presentation. And I agree with Rob, this is a hugely important area, so thanks for putting it back on the agenda. A gratuitous suggestion, comment, to take the issue forward. A really simple idea which I like is that to make as a requirement for receiving the age pension at 70 or 75, everyone must have a plan as to where that they go for assisted care or nursing care. So everyone nominates where they're going to go. And I think putting that sort of planning requirement would really focus the issue on where do I go next and also how do you fund it and what do I have to do. But I think you're right, there's a perception that it's too difficult, I'm not going to think about it.
I think once you get to that age of 70, 75, though, I think people are very happy to think about it and discuss it. I've attended some of the forums that Mark Butler, the Minister for Mental Health and Ageing, has run with older people, consulting them, and they've got no problems talking about their issues and their concerns. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem to arise until you really are sort of looking down the barrel of that period in your life, so to speak.
Well, maybe it's earlier, but yeah, I really like that idea because a lot of the times people get to that point and it's actually too late for them to start planning and making the decisions out of their hands. But I think if you had that requirement, so at least have some thought about it.
And I think that the issue of control and choice is what will appeal to people. And certainly that's one of the reasons why it's been particularly successful in France, is appealing to people saying, you don't have to be dependent on your children. You know, this insurance will allow you to make your own decisions, not be a burden, etc., which is a big issue for some people. Thanks, Darren. Was that the bell?
I think that was the final bell, but if there's one more, we probably can get it in before the door opens. Ah, too late. There you go.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Bridget. Thank you.